In the summer of 2005, an out-of-control dump truck careened down Avon Mountain, causing a crash and fire that resulted in the death of five people. This is where we live. I'm John Dankowski. After the crash, the state responded by changing rules for truck inspections and literally moving a mountain in an effort to make Route 44 safer. Today, Where We Live, a look at the aftermath of that accident and the lessons we've learned about how we react and rebuild after tragedy. Mark Robinson, author of Smoke, Fire, and Angels, Tragedy on Avon Mountain and the Life-Changing Aftermath, joins us in studio to talk about his book. We'll also talk to Tom Condon of the Hartford Current about what this accident can teach us about how we rebuild after tragedy. And we'll get a status update from the DOT on the ongoing massive changes to a very dangerous roadway. It's all coming up Where We Live right after this news. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. On July 29th, 2005, at 7:38 a.m., I was right in the middle of my commute to work, and I was on foot. That summer, I was working as an editor at National Public Radio in Washington, and I was riding the D.C. Metro from Clarendon, Virginia, into town. It was a far different commute than I was used to. It's usually a 25-mile drive down country roads, past strip malls, and into Hartford from my home in Winsted. After a morning meeting at NPR and several newspapers later, I saw an alert come up on my computer screen about a new urgent story that was hitting the wires in Avon, Connecticut. I felt sick, and I felt a bit guilty that I wasn't there. The story said that an out-of-control dump truck had careened down Avon Mountain on Route 44, causing a fiery crash and killing four people. Before I called the newsroom at WNPR, I walked outside the building, and I called my wife. Now, she doesn't travel that part of the road. She's a teacher in New Hartford, but like we all remember on September 11th, you know, you call just to make sure everyone's safe. She was safe, but she was crying. She just found out that Chip Stotler, the father of five of her students, had died in that crash. I couldn't believe what she was saying. Their big family was a big part of life at the school. There was a sign near the front of the door that read, Stotler Parking. Of all the people, I thought, why the hell would Chip Stotler be there? Every single thought I had was how I wished I was back home, but then I realized something. If I had been home, I would have made that commute. If I wasn't standing on a street corner in Washington at 7:38, I would have been sitting in a car right next to Chip. Now, Mark Robinson was there. He was in his car at the base of the mountain. His book, Smoke, Fire, and Angels, recounts the day of the accident and the aftermath. Today, Where We Live, we'll talk with him about making sense of tragedy and what changes it's prompted. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. We'll also be talking with Tom Condon of the Hartford Current today, and we'll be getting a status update from the DOT on the massive changes to a very dangerous roadway. First, I want to welcome in Mark Robinson, the author of Smoke, Fire, and Angels. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, John.
Why were you there that day?
I was going to work. It was just a normal day, and I remember leaving for work at the normal time, and the one thing that I do remember clearly is that I had a long list of things to get done at work that day, and I remember scolding myself as I drove down 44 from Canton, thinking that I should have left an hour earlier.
Did you ever think of that roadway as dangerous when you were driving in every day?
I had heard all the things about Avon Mountain. Obviously, it has a long history. I always think that people, overdo it and make more of it than it really was, but I guess I was wrong about that.
One of the things that you talk about in the book, and I want to talk obviously about the people and about the accident, some of the things that you learned about the aftermath, but you talk a little bit about some of these life-changing events, these decisions, and the fact that you ended up there as opposed to somewhere else. Is that something you think about when you make a commute, a long commute into work every day, that just 5 minutes late, an hour late, 5 minutes early, you're there doing something that perhaps you shouldn't be?
Yeah, as far as that day goes, no, I didn't think about that at all. It was just a normal day. I mean, you look back and you think, if it wasn't for this, it wasn't for that. I almost called the book Twists of Fate. There are so many stories of people who were either there or not there due to very little minor changes in their normal routine that day. And I don't know that there are any answers to that because, again, people were either missed being at the point of impact or were at the point of impact due to tiny changes in their normal routine.
Tell me a little bit about what you saw when you were there, because obviously you were someone who was part of the accident, but you lived to tell about it and to write a book about it. What did you see at the time?
Well, that's one of the big things about, I think, why I ended up writing a book about it, because I don't remember anything. I woke up in the hospital with 9 broken bones and a punctured lung, and I didn't know what had happened to me, so I had a lot of questions, and that's what propelled me The last thought I had driving to work that day was, again, that I had a lot of things to get done at work that day. And next thing, I was in the emergency room.
One of the people that you quote in here, though, had something very clear go through his head. So this is how I'm going to die.
Yeah, Michael Cummings. He was right near me, near the front of the line of traffic. And he was focused on the light, waiting for it to change from red to green. It changed to green. He changed his focus, saw the truck. And I asked him, I said, did you have time to move your car? Or he said, no, I had time for one thought, and that's, so this is how I'm going to die.
So as you got out of the hospital, as you started to piece this together, what led you to really want to write this book and put the story together? How did you start to gather information?
Well, it was all about the people because, again, I had a lot of questions about how I ended up in that condition. And as I started to put the pieces together, I started to learn about people like Chip Stotler and Maureen Edlin and Barbara Bongiovanni and Raheem Nafi, the truck driver. And they were incredible people. So once I learned, that it could have just as easily been me as it was then that propelled me in one sense. I really wanted to honor their memories. They were great people. And then there was the rescue effort. The rescue effort was phenomenal. 300 people descended on the scene that day, firefighters, cops, emergency services workers, passersby. They did just amazingly kind and courageous things that day. So the more I learned, the more I was motivated to write a story about it.
I want to bring in Tom Condon. He's the editor of Place, a section of the Hartford Courant that writes about so many of the issues that we talk about here on Where We Live. And he's, of course, been on this program before. Tom, welcome back.
Thank you, John.
I want to get your sense about what you felt, what you thought whenever you heard about this crash, given what we know about commuting patterns out there, what we know about the dangers of Route 44. What did you think when you heard about this?
Well, you had a sense of the old expression, an accident waiting to happen. The traffic on that road is always gone too fast. I believe that the road was over-designed. It was designed as a highway in a very urban context. I commuted over it 1 year ago, and with the weather, with the geometry of the hill, it's terribly dangerous. And there had been, in the 5 years prior to the crash, I believe the number is 365 accidents. It's terribly dangerous. And, you just had the sense of, oh, it finally happened, a really bad one. So, real issue there, individual responsibility, but the design of the road invites speed. And speed, a lot of factors, but speed is the biggest one. And problem there. And question as to whether that problem is being resolved.
And we're going to talk about that in just a little bit as we hear from the DOT. And we'll also take some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. What do you remember about the day of that Avon crash? And do you travel Route 44? Of course, there's a lot of people who don't know very much, who listen around the state and around the region, who don't know about the topography in the area. Mark Robinson, tell us about what Avon Mountain's all about. Explain what the drive over the mountain's like, because I think you have the same reaction that a lot of people do, which is, it's not a very big deal. I come from Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, this is a hill. This isn't a mountain. Mm-hmm. But maybe you can describe a little bit about what it's like to people who don't know it.
Well, it is a little tricky. It's, you drive along Route 44. It's a busy two-way in both directions, road leading to and from Hartford. It's the main commuting artery from the Farmington Valley to Hartford. So it's very busy, and it was never designed to handle, I think, that volume of traffic. I think it's 23,000 cars a day go over the mountain. So that's a lot of traffic. But when you get to the base of the mountain, you have a light, it's a big intersection, then you immediately go up the mountain, and it's a very steep upgrade, or if you're coming the other way, a very steep downgrade. And, there are a lot of twists and turns, and you have to be on your toes. And if you're going too fast, if you're not paying attention, if you're distracted by a cell phone or radio, you're going to be in trouble because there's very little margin for error. You really have to stay on your toes.
Of course, this accident that happened, and we'll get more into the details of this as we go, it was a dump truck that had all sorts of inspection problems and went out of control and came down at a very high rate of speed. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the accidents that Tom was talking about happen on a more regular basis. As I drive up and down that mountain every day, in the wintertime, people will slide and go across the center lane where there's no barrier between the very fast-moving up traffic and the mm-hmm. very fast-moving down traffic. And Tom Condon, there's accidents there constantly, not the major tragic ones, but occasionally
sure.
fatalities, too.
Oh, absolutely. I think probably the best thing to come out of the redesign will be a median, because the majority of accidents involve lane crossing. So that's going to be a good thing.
The accident that actually happened that day, though, was caused by a dump truck. Mm-hmm. And you talked a little bit about the driver. And in the book, you recount his travels as well as the travels of the other people who got to that place at the time. Tell us, Mark Robinson, about that truck and how it got to be on the road and how it got to be in that place at that time.
Well, the truck is owned by David Wilcox. His company at the time was American Crushing and Recycling. Mr. Wilcox had a track record that was pretty extensive. He had 1,136 safety violations. That truck, as it turned out, in the post-crash inspection, had 20 pre-crash violations, including four that were considered out of service, which means that they were serious enough that had that truck been inspected at any point prior to the crash, it would have been pulled off the road. And three of those were brake violations. So the truck was in horrible shape. And you know, people have speculated about the driver. Well, I really consider Raheem Nafi as much of a victim of this crash as anybody else. He was in a very dangerous vehicle that day. It had a long history of problems. And, you know, he, to his credit, I think, was trying to do his best to avoid hitting other cars. But as the investigation, I think, proved pretty conclusively, the truck didn't have brakes. The brakes were not functioning properly that day, not even close. And no matter what he did, no matter how good a driver he was or wasn't, as far as downshifting and some of those other factors, the brakes didn't work. He missed the turn at the top of the mountain. He was supposed to turn left onto Deer Cliff. He had made the same trip 20 times the day before. He knew where he was going. He couldn't make the turn that day. Why couldn't he make the turn? He was in a different truck the day before. So when you look at all these things and the test that they did on the mountain about a year later where they tested a similar kind of truck, both loaded and unloaded, going faster and slower, they proved conclusively that when a Mack truck's brakes are functioning properly, it will stop when you hit the brakes. You don't need to downshift. You don't need to do a lot of other things. And Raheem Nafi was just in a very, very, awful position that day. And, I think he deserves our sympathy, not our blame.
Mark Robinson is author of Smoke, Fire, and Angels, Tragedy on Avon Mountain, and the Life-Changing Aftermath. Tom Condon is also here. He's from the Hartford Courant. We're talking today about the aftermath of tragedy and how we react and rebuild in the state. In just a little bit, we'll be talking with an official from the Department of Transportation a little bit about what's being done to remake Avon Mountain. If you'd like to call 860-275-7266, we'd especially like to hear from you if this commute is part of your everyday life. Let's go quickly to Bruce, who's calling from West Hartford. Bruce, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Yes, thank you. I've driven Avon Mountain. I've lived in West Hartford all my life, and I've driven that mountain forever. And I always try to avoid it anyway by going on Route 10 through Simsbury and crossing over. But the thing that really vexed me about the whole situation was Wilcox's committal and then subsequent sentencing, which I didn't think was requisite to the crime he committed, given as the author said, his record of irresponsibility and corruption for years. And I would just like them to please comment on the idea of, rather than revamping the whole roadway, probably is that really the answer, or is it really enforcing existing laws in the books? Thank you.
Bruce, thank you very much for your phone call. So Mark Robinson, first I'll go to you. You hear his question. There were existing laws about truck inspections, certainly. Those laws had many, many loopholes in them. Maybe you can explain how we came to a place where we had a truck so heavy, so loaded up, that was able to go up and down a mountain without brakes.
Well, yeah, you get into a whole lot of things here. I mean, clearly Wilcox was primarily responsible for what happened that day, but you can argue that he wouldn't have been on the mountain that day had he not been run out of business. He really should have been. The state at one point did fail him on a safety inspection of his overall business. He just changed the name of the company. He went from Wilcox Trucking to American Crushing and Recycling. He just changed the shingle outside the door. How he got away with that is amazing to me. Not only did the state not run him out of business, he had 1,136 violations again. They gave him business. They gave him $1.6 million worth of business. So there's that. There's the 1993 legislation that was designed to get uninsured motorists off the road, a good thing. However, there was an explicit exclusion written into that legislation to exclude commercial entities. So that was a loophole that Mr. Wilcox exploited over and over again. And no one can explain to me why that loophole was written into that law. It was closed within about a month or so after the crash, which was, I think, kind of an admission of that this shouldn't have been there to begin with.
But why was it there? It's crazy. And then you look at the history of the mountain. That was the seventh truck in 21 years to lose its brakes going down the mountain. After the July 05 crash, basically there was a lot of harumphing among politicians, but essentially the only thing that really got done was bigger signs. It wasn't until the eighth truck in 23 years, the one that crashed into Nassau's, that's when some of these major changes started to really occur.
And this was another large truck that came down the mountain. Thankfully, no one was killed, but it went all the way through the intersection, the same intersection you were sitting at, the same intersection where that accident happened, and went into a furniture store. Tom Condon, how much blame do we lay at the feet of maybe the legislature, others who allowed loopholes like this to happen? When we put Mr. Wilcox in prison, that's one thing, but how much of this should have been taken care of legislatively?
Well, it's obviously easier to look back and spot these faults. I mean, I think part of what happened here is the development of that corridor over time. That was a country road within living memory, and each of the West Hartford and Avon have allowed more and more development along the road, throwing more and more traffic into it. And as that happened, it became more and more dangerous. And there was no concurrent awareness that they were pouring so many thousands of cars a day onto that road and what the implications were. So that's part of the challenge as well.
I want to get to one more phone call before our break. John is calling from West Hartford. John, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
How are you today?
Doing well, thanks. What's on your mind?
I have two comments. First comment is I travel that road daily, or several times a week, I should say. And we have a standing joke, my family and I. We call it Interstate 44. I'm amazed at how stupid people are in the way that they drive that mountain. I mean, you try to set your cruise control to 45 to maintain the speed limit, and people will go by you at 65 and 70 miles per hour, passing on the right in the curve sections, and it's just people need to slow down and respect the mountain because it is a very dangerous road. And that's a good comment that was made, that the road was a country road. I can remember in my childhood going to Avon with my family growing up, and it was a small two-lane road that over the course of time has been widened to four lanes, and it's still a dangerous road. Also, we were living in Avon during the crash, and the evening of the crash, we had gone out to dinner at one of the restaurants right on 44, and it was a horrific sight. Probably around 9:30 that evening, it was just a parade of all the vehicles on flatbeds being taken away from the accident site, and everybody in the restaurant stepped outside, and you could just see the horrific look on everybody's face as those vehicles passed by, and it was a sad day.
John, thank you very much for your phone call. I appreciate it.
Have a good day.
But before we get to our break, Tom Condon, and this isn't the only road in Connecticut where clearly we engineered it a long, long time ago to be a country road, and it's turned into a highway, a super highway 44,
sure.
as the caller says.
Interstate 44.
Yeah, Interstate 44. I mean, give me some other examples. This is something that clearly we have in more places than just feeding the Farmington River Valley.
Well, I mean, there's a situation. We have a lot of interstates in Connecticut. There has been a tendency, though, to treat some of the of the urban arterials as interstates, and to create wide shoulders and soft turning lanes and everything else, which induces speed. I mean, the caller is absolutely right. You go 45 on the mountain, and people will pass you right side, left side all the time, going 60 or 70. They are invited to do that by the design of the road. And I still question. I look forward to speaking to the DOT to see if that problem is solved.
And when we come back from our break, we will be talking with Jim Norman. He's acting engineering administrator for the Connecticut Department of Transportation. Our guests are Tom Condon. He's the columnist and the editor of Place, the Hartford Current section. Mark Robinson is here. He's author of Smoke, Fire, and Angels, Tragedy on Avon Mountain and the Life-Changing Aftermath. We'd like you to call 860-275-7266 and join the conversation here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about how we react and rebuild after tragedy in Connecticut. Our guest is Mark Robinson. He's author of Smoke, Fire, and Angels. It's about the Avon Mountain crash back in 2005. We're going to be taking your phone calls in just a bit at 860-275-7266. You can also email us where we live at WNPR.org. Also joining us today is Tom Condon from the Hartford Courant. And joining us by phone right now is Jim Norman. He's Acting Engineering Administrator for the Connecticut Department of Transportation. Jim Norman, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
I'm wondering, first of all, if you can fill us in a little bit on how the progress is going on the rebuilding of Route 44 over Avon Mountain.
Actually, it's going pretty well in construction. The design plans were very complete, very well coordinated, and the work right now is being evidenced in construction. Our construction forces and the contractor doing a lot of good preparation in advance of activities. They're following the plans, which were pretty extensive with respect to sedimentation, erosion control, staging, and it looks pretty good out there. It's moving ahead on schedule.
The construction began, the first phase of everything, as Mark Robinson had said earlier, was really just to put up bigger signs. And then after that, after this other truck accident, began construction on a ramp that would catch runaway vehicles. Maybe you can talk just briefly about that design and how exactly that was all put together, the decisions that were made as far as putting a truck off-ramp at the very bottom of the hill right next to the Avon Old Farms Inn, a classic old inn at the bottom of the mountain there.
Well, maybe I can just drop back a little bit and
sure.
Kind of comprehensively look at everything that took place. The Capital Region Council of Governments commissioned a study of Route 44 from Hartford out to Canton. And from that study, they prioritized the Avon Mountain section as that being requiring improvements due to the severity of accidents. So at the time of the horrific truck accident that occurred at the base of the mountain, we were already engaged in preliminary design activities for improvements to that section of roadway. After the truck accident took place, there was a governor formed a task force, DOT, Federal Highway, and planning agency officials to look at measures to address safety. Design work obviously continued on the project, and then various improvement measures were brought forward. There were some immediate, some short-term. There was a project, and there was also longer-term measures. A series of short-term measures were the traffic signing, police ticketing areas, the resurfacing of the curves with higher friction pavement, the electronic stop ahead signs were relocated. There were variable message signs to indicate conditions out there. A weather station was installed near the top of the mountain, and those were done immediately. Design progressed on the project, and we had neighborhood meetings, a public hearing, and then in September of 2007 was the second truck accident where a truck went into the Nassau furniture store beyond the intersection. It was at that point in time where the decision was made to proceed with a truck escape ramp, and that was by emergency declaration of the commissioner on October 1st of 2007. And that truck escape ramp was installed and operational by February, about 5 months later.
So, of course, many people saw that as a very important step in making the roadway safer, but so much else about that road has been so unsafe for many years. As Tom Condon and I were talking about a moment ago, many of the accidents on the roadway happen when people cross over the center lane. Many of them have to do with speed of cars, not runaway trucks. Explain, if you would, briefly, how this roadway is being remade in order to make a safer roadway for all vehicles. What exactly is being changed? Because those of us who drive up and down the mountain each day see a lot of stuff being moved around and aren't exactly sure what it's going to look like at the end.
Okay, the finished product will be, the major components are the softening of the curves, not straightening of the curves, not trying to turn it into a highway. It's taking the two very sharp curves, one immediately west of Deer Cliff and one east of Pine Tree and Wright Drive. And if you look at accident history on the mountain, those two curves are just clusters of accidents. So what we've done in design is to soften the curve somewhat, not to a high design speed, looking at something in the range of the posted speed limit, and then also have the curves from the very top of the hill, then through Deer Cliff and through Pine Tree, all with very much the same curvature, so that a driver doesn't enter one curve and then get taken off guard by a much sharper curve afterwards. So there's a uniformity of the treatment. We've also looked to not increase speeds. That was clearly a concern out there, so our design specifically addressed that by not a straightening, just softening, looking at a landscape median to separate traffic so you don't have a wide expanse of road. There will be landscaping and texture in a median. There will be a cable type of barrier. Should someone still drive it at a very high speed, the cable would be there to arrest you before you go into the other direction of travel.
I want to get to a quick question. And sure. if you're on the line, please hang on for 1 second because we'd like to get to some of your comments and questions.
Sure.
At 860-275-7266. We've got a question here for Jim Norman from the DOT, from Mark Robinson, who's one of our guests in studio. Mark?
Yeah, thanks, John. Jim, people say to me when they see that truck ramp that they don't think it's going to be effective. I know that the families who lost loved ones that day probably wish that Raheem Nafi had the option that day to use a ramp, and we can never know if a driver will actually take advantage of it. There could be, for instance, a vehicle between the driver and that ramp if someone's coming down that hill losing their brakes.
Right.
But if the driver exercises the option to use that ramp, will that ramp be effective?
Yes, it will. Yeah, that was designed, and it's there are other examples. We fashioned this off a system used in a town called Buffalo, Wyoming, where they had put in a truck escape ramp, very similar design, and it was used. You know, there was some damage to the truck, but the driver was fine, and that's what we're using out there. I think the good part with the truck escape ramp was just the immediacy of being able to put that into place, and that was the concern. We also had, by means of a task force that was formed after the accident, looked at the possibility of a grade separation intersection of the base of the hill so that 10 and 44 would never intersect. There would be no conflict. That was a very expensive, elaborate plan, and it would have wetland impacts, property impacts, historic, and it remains as a consideration, but clearly that would be many, many years before that were constructed.
I have a question here from Tom Condon from The Current.
Jim, doesn't softening the curves invite faster speed?
Well, softening is trying to provide a consistent speed throughout. Clearly, the two very sharp curves that are out there were not being negotiated by vehicles, and we really had clusters of accidents. And in an 11-year period of time, we had 10 fatal accidents on that section of roadway, most of those curves. So we had to get the curves in line with what most people can reasonably drive those at.
Was any consideration given to reducing the design speed to, say, 35 miles an hour?
I think that it would be very hard for us to do two things. One would be to get people to drive at 30 miles per hour over the hill, and the other would be you could create an alignment, which would be a series of curves down through the hill, but it would be tremendously impacting with respect to abutting property owners. So physically it could be done, but you'd really be impacting everybody all along that roadway.
Well, that's going to happen anyway, isn't it?
No, there were some properties that were impacted, but nowhere near the degree if you were to completely run a snake alignment all the way up and over the hill.
Well, you still can't get away from the geometry of the hill, though, right? I mean, you're still going to have, it's still a matter of physics.
Well, to a degree, that's absolutely correct. And, you know, the road was actually incorporated in 1798, well before motorized travel. And, you know, it's the product of the geometry. There's very few crossings of the of the ridge separating the Hartford and Farmington Valley.
Right. Jim Norman from the Connecticut DOT is here with us, and in studio here on Where We Live, we have Mark Robinson. He's the author of Smoke, Fire, and Angels, Tragedy on Avon Mountain, and the Life-Changing Aftermath. And Tom Condon is here from the Hartford Current as well. I want to get to some phone calls in just a moment here. Let's go to BJ, who is calling from Bristol. BJ, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hey, guys. I wanted to comment on one thing. The truck itself, had that truck been safe, the accident would not have happened. I think we can all agree on that. So let's focus on that. I've been a commercial driver in Connecticut for 22 years. I've seen the effort that the DOT and the DMV Enforcement Division puts out to inspect these trucks coming in and out of the state and operate in the state. I will tell you that one thing, when they put a truck out of service, they have to find a way, somebody has to find a way to disable these trucks until it is fixed and signed off by a DOT inspector. That's one. Number two, the safety effort. There is not enough guys out there doing safety inspections. Thousands of trucks are on these roads every day. We are not putting out a good enough effort to inspect and disable these unsafe trucks. Again, I will remind you, the root cause of that accident was an unsafe truck, and we can do all the road engineering and the speed control and everything. And if we have another unsafe truck going down that hill into the valley, that that ramp that was installed there that to stop the trucks, I've looked at that thing, and I was there a few weeks ago. When you're in a panic situation, your truck brakes have failed, I don't think that ramp's going to be effective at all. And I see that if we don't put in a better effort to inspect and disable these unsafe trucks, I see something similar happening again.
BJ, thank you very much for your phone call. Mark Robinson, you were nodding your head there. I mean, I think there's a lot to what he has to say. Obviously, he's in the trucking business, and he knows about safety inspections.
And enforcement's a huge part of the equation here. And it always comes down to a matter of resources. There was stepped-up enforcement after the crash, but, you know, the headlines fade, and the enforcement seems to fade with it, which is not to say that there aren't a lot of law enforcement out there doing a great job. There are. But I think that we need to be very vigilant about it, to his point. If that truck was safe, that we wouldn't be having this conversation today.
And Jim Norman, to what BJ said about the off-ramp there at the bottom of the hill, I think many people look at that on a daily basis, people in the trucking business, and wonder whether or not the design of that really does cause keep another accident from happening.
Yes, I think that, you know, it does provide some fail-safe measure at the base of the hill. I think that's true. Clearly, if trucks and cars all were properly maintained, that would definitely be a benefit. And so it's various things playing in, yes.
Jennifer is calling from New Preston. Jennifer, you're on Where We Live. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. What's up?
Well, I'm curious. I've been curious why, number one, there have been passing lanes on that road coming down that hill. Number two, would it be possible at some point to build a separate road for trucks as a real safety measure? And the third was, I lived for 18 years on a dangerous intersection over here in New Preston, and on a monthly basis saw car accidents in front of my house. I finally wrote to the state police, and I got a letter back saying that the body count was not high enough in the intersection, which was devastating to get a letter like that. And I wondered what the average citizen can do who observes patterns like that and wants to, have more safety measures. Is there, what's the best venue for me to contact someone and say this is a dangerous intersection? And I'll go off the air. Thank you.
Jennifer, thank you very much for your question. And obviously, Jim Norman, you're an engineering administrator for the DOT, and you're not taking all of these questions from people on a daily basis. If you, though, hear from somebody like Jennifer who says, I have a problem with the roadway, what do I do? Well, what does she do?
She can write to the manager of traffic engineering at the Department of Transportation, and we have responsibility for all state roadways, and local roadways are municipal authority. So state roadways, when we get requests to investigate locations, that's exactly what we do.
I got a quick question from a caller who wonders, can you put some sort of grooves in the pavement? Is there something in the pavement that you can do to actually slow people down to keep the traffic from moving so fast?
Well, sometimes we have some grooving is put in more for an awareness of a stop condition or whatever. But in Connecticut, if we do, you know, a rumble strip type of approach, they immediately are taken out because we get complaints from neighboring property owners on noise impacts. I think in other parts of the United States, they're used. And in Connecticut, you know, on a few applications we've tried, as soon as we put them in, we take them out.
A last question for you, Jim Norman, before I let you go.
Sure.
When do you expect this project of rebuilding Avon Mountain, as we see it right now, when do we see this finished?
It'll be the end of next year. It was a three-season construction project. And, you know, there were obviously topography constraints. There's wetlands. And the job is very carefully staged. We couldn't just go in and clear and remove everything on the mountain all at one time. And we're being sensitive to the environment and progressing the job. So it's really a three-season job. So the end of next year, the improvements will all be in place.
Do you have a sense of how much this will cost when it's all said and done, and how much over, I'm assuming, over any stated budget it's going to go?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's over budget. I would say the existing construction is in the range of $15 million. The truck escape ramp was about $4 million.
And that's within the budget that you've been given to do this over the course of this three-season construction project?
Correct.
Very good. Jim Norman from the Connecticut DOT, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
When we continue our conversation with Tom Condon and Mark Robinson, we're going to take some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. If you travel that roadway, we'd love your impressions. We're going to be talking more about other tragic accidents that have happened in Connecticut and how we design and rebuild after them with Tom Condon. It's all coming up where we live here on WNPR. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, the ongoing health care debate in Washington is drawing the states back in. What if Connecticut gets to opt in or opt out of a federal health plan? State health care advocate Kevin Lembo joins us to answer your questions about the changing world of health insurance. And we'll also hear new music from the Needle Drops' Anthony Fantano. It's all coming up tomorrow on Where We Live. You can join the conversation on air and online at WNPR.org. Today we're talking about how we react and rebuild after tragedy in Connecticut. Our guest is Mark Robinson, author of Smoke, Fire, and Angels. It's about the Avon Mountain crash in 2005. And we're taking your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Tom Condon is also here. He's from the Place section of the Hartford Courant. Let's go to the phones. We want to hear from Mark, who's calling from Andover. Mark, you're on Where We Live.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, go ahead. What's up?
I guess my comment is from a driver's point of view. I mentioned to your producer, I've been driving since about 1975. I've been driving trucks, local, regional garbage trucks, dump trucks, some over the road. Without passing judgment on the driver that day, not having been in that truck, knowing that there were issues with the vehicle, the rule of thumb that I learned way back was you go down a hill in the same gear as you go up a hill. Speed is often the factor. People drive today, they rely on their brakes, both cars and trucks, when they're really not the only source of stopping in a normal condition as well as a emergency condition. So if that truck loaded, underloaded, overloaded, there's no way he could have climbed that hill in a high gear at a high speed. So he should have been going down the hill at a lower speed, in a lower gear, which controls most of that overspeeding. It can still come into a runaway condition, but it begins with a much lower speed, a more controllable, out-of-control situation, if you kind of get the sense of that.
No, I understand that. And for many of us who do not work in that business, it's good for us to hear how truck drivers do their work. Thank you very much, Mark, for your phone call. Mark Robinson?
Yeah, no, I think we'll never know. I mean, you could speculate about Raheem Nafi's ability as a truck driver, and I suspect there are things he could have been doing better. But the bottom line is those brakes didn't work. If he was not able to slow the truck enough to make the left-hand turn at the top of the mountain onto Deer Cliff, that indicated a real problem as it was. And again, the test that was done a year later by the regional accident reconstruction team proved that if the brakes worked properly, that Nafi would not have been in that position.
Robert in Canton, go ahead. You're on Where We Live, Robert.
Thank you. I live in Canton, so go over the road frequently. I was, in fact, one of those caught in the huge backup the morning that the accident occurred. I remember in childhood, I lived a year in Avon. My mother, who was an excellent driver, was white-knuckled at times when she'd have to go over the road, over the mountain, by that road. So my question is, why, instead of simply widening the road, making a few smallish changes to it, why wasn't a tunnel put through? We do have tunnels elsewhere in Connecticut. I'm not aware of any geological impediment to putting a tunnel through this mountain. Was it simply the cost?
Tom Condon, this is a road we heard earlier. This is a road that's been in service, what, since the 1700s, right?
1798, yeah. Yeah. No, that point has been made, and it was made when these accidents happened. It's simply the cost. Tunnels are hugely expensive. And oddly enough, there is very little tunnel technology in this country. There are very few people who build tunnels. It's actually hard. If you had the money, it's hard to build one.
In Europe, they build a lot of tunnels.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Before we get to some more phone calls, Tom, you know, we just talked to the Department of Transportation. I'm not sure if any of us are convinced that we're going to necessarily see this roadway be completely safe afterward, or whether or not we can truly make any of these roadways safer. I'm wondering if, as you watch this as an observer and reporting on this, whether or not you feel as though this fits into some sort of a pattern of the way Connecticut reacts after tragedies. There have certainly been other major tragedies on the roadways in Connecticut, and we do react in unusual ways to them sometimes.
Yeah, we do something. I think, you know, the Mayanus River Bridge collapse is actually illustrative of a couple of trends. And that was 1983. If you were here, you remember it. A major section of I-95 collapsed in Greenwich, three people were killed, three more seriously injured. And what happened there was that DOT used to get its money from the general fund. And for a few years prior to 83, there have been tight budgets, and their budgets have been cut. And this points to one of the continual problems in government. You know, there's always pressure to cut spending. But when you cut spending on essential services, you're going to pay the tab in the long run. That's more irresponsible than overspending in many contexts. Now, the innovative thing to come out of it was the realization by Governor O'Neill and his OPM secretary, Anthony Milano, one of the great public servants of the last 30 years, that they needed a separate, sustainable way to pay for highways and roads, and they created the Special Transportation Fund. That was initially at $5.6 billion, and it went for a generation repairing roads and highways. It didn't address the whole state's transportation problem, but it did fix the roads, bridges, and highways.
Of course, around that same time, there was another accident. There was an accident at a toll plaza.
Stratford.
In Stratford. Because of that, in part, we don't have toll collection on the roadways in Connecticut. Most of the rest of the Northeast does.
Mm-hmm.
Was our reaction to that accident, in your mind, Tom Condon, the wrong reaction? Does that keep us from necessarily keeping people off the roads in some of these very high density areas, and also raise the money, as tolls can do, to make roadway improvements?
Well, in retrospect, yes, but at the time it was the right thing to do. We didn't have the transponder technology then that we have now. It's much easier to put tolls back now, so it's really a different debate right now. Those old toll plazas were dangerous; they were terrible on the air quality in certain areas. Different time.
And if we come back with tolls, it's going to be a different type of tolls in Connecticut. Certainly,
you would
technology.
Have to then throwing quarters into a bin. Yeah, you'd have to think so.
we would hope so. John is in Colebrook. John, you're on Where We Live.
Yeah, good morning.
Hi.
To me, this is there's a very interesting conflict in this story here, where it's basically the strong spirit and empathy of the people who responded that day that Mark talks about quite a bit in the book, versus a very strong trucking lobby in the state of Connecticut, which allows things like companies to keep going after thousands of... They basically have a very obvious disregard for the safety of the rest of us, and, you know, that allow things like the insurance loophole where Wilcox had no insurance and had no legal requirement to have insurance, which seems to get lost in part of this story.
John, thank you very much. Mark Robinson, one of the things obviously that's in the book is why we ended up with the particular regulatory environment we did, why some of these loopholes are here.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that there's things going on in the legislative process that affects the way certain laws are written up. But, you know, the fact is, and I interviewed Chip Mowry, he's a mechanic supervisor with Gabrielli Trucks in Hartford, and he talks about, I mean, the David Wilcoxes, thank God, are the exception. There are so many companies out there that do it the right way, that maintain their trucks properly and take safety very seriously. Chip Mowry told me that he tells his guys that, you know, these big trucks are going out there among our own wives and children and brothers and sisters, and we have an obligation to make sure they're safe. So there are a lot of people out there who will tell you that, you know, they pay attention to these things. They understand the importance and the implications. There are a few bad apples out there like Wilcox, and when there's such a long track record to make that well known, then, you know, I would say that it's up to the law enforcement officials and the state people to get these guys out of business.
Cheryl and Avon. Cheryl, you're on Where We Live. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. This is a very good show. I am from Avon. I was at the intersection on Route 10 the day of the accident. It was horrific, to say the least. I have a couple of questions. One, I'm curious about why there are new roadways being carved into 44, other housing developments, so that just adds to the on and off onto Route 44. The second one, I guess, is my question about speeding. The whole idea of having lights, which I know is intrusive to some, may be a good deterrent, because a couple of callers ago talked about speeding. We're on the road sometimes twice a day, and speeding is really a very major issue. So the design may be good, but I don't see how we're going to have people slow down without some of this oversight. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you very much, Tom Condon. Yeah.
I agree. There was a transportation consultant in Hartford, Tony Gold, suggested making it one lane each way, making it more like a boulevard, with that whole the whole purpose of slowing traffic down. That of course hasn't been the approach that DOT has taken, but it remains a good point. It is still, you still have acceleration equals force over mass. We're still going to have people coming down that road too fast.
But it's not just slowing traffic down, Mark Robinson. As the caller also says, we drive that road every day. We see that we are engineering a road, whether or not it's allowing for more shopping centers, allowing for more subdivisions off the road. We are cramming more people down the road, and so no matter how we build it, it doesn't really matter, because we're trying to put more people there, it seems.
Yeah, and ultimately it's all going to come down to our individual responsibility. We all have a responsibility to drive like sane people and make sure our cars are maintained. I mean, there are going to be certain problems with this roadway no matter what happens. I'm glad these improvements are taking place, but ultimately it's going to come down to all of us as individuals.
You know, there's one ancillary issue here, and it's an environmental one. Why isn't the state of Connecticut protecting the ridgelines? Those are environmentally sensitive areas. They shouldn't be allowing any development on those ridgelines, and this is adding to this problem.
When we say ridgeline again, this roadway goes up over a ridge, and there is housing, and there are housing developments being built all along this ridgeline even as we speak, with some of the same types of trucks that caused that problem that day, that accident. Those same type of trucks are going up and down there every day building.
The truck 8 that was caused the crash that day was going to put more fill down for a house that's being built on the ridge on Deer Cliff. As if the view from Deer Cliff from the top of the ridge isn't good enough, they were actually elevating the property so they would get an even better view. That's where the truck was going that day to put the foundation in for that house.
To elevate the property for a better view.
Right.
We just have a minute or so left, Mark Robinson. Obviously, this is something that has meant a lot to you. I will say that this book, Smoke, Fire, and Angels, the proceeds of this book are donated to a fund to help those affected by the crash. Maybe you just talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, we're talking about all these important issues, and we do need to make these road improvements. But I don't want to forget in the process that there are five people who lost their lives as a result of this crash. They were great people. You've talked about Chip Stotler. He was an amazing man. Every one of these five people were terrific people. And I just want to make sure that we honor their memories and don't forget that, you know, as we deal with these problems, the people left behind, the families who are dealing with the loss of their loved ones, go on every day. And it's just been an ongoing horror for them. And on top of that, you know, they lose their loved ones, but they're also dealing with financial implications as a result of this. When a bridge collapsed in Minneapolis in the summer of 2007, 13 people were killed. The Minnesota legislature made sure that those families were taken care of within a year. So are the people of Minnesota more fair-minded and compassionate than the people of Connecticut? We can do a lot better for the families who lost loved ones that day than we have. And I really want the legislators to pay attention to that, because I think they have a responsibility to address this question.
Mark Robinson, the book is Smoke, Fire, and Angels, Tragedy on Avon Mountain, and the Life-Changing Aftermath. Thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Tom Condon, again, from Place. It's part of the Hartford Current, and he joins us periodically on the show. Tom, thanks for coming in again. I appreciate
it. Thank
you, John. We'd like you to continue this conversation online. If you have comments, maybe some stories about traveling over Avon Mountain, we'd love to hear them. Go to WNPR.org, keyword where. Libby Kahn produces our show. The senior producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us.